Cheers.
Cheers, everybody. Day four? Day five?
Friday, so.
No hot D?
Yeah, day five, no hot D.
How's everybody feeling?
Well, we watched the episode like 3 minutes ago, so I'm feeling renewed. We're not too far gone yet. It's going to really hurt in about 2 weeks.
Yeah, we're still dripping wet from the Storm's End. Storms just can't, they just go everywhere. You really can't control that stuff.
I've been hungry since watching that Vegas scene, seeing him get a nice bite to eat.
The sideways swoop. Like from the cutscene of an adventure game. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my God, don't do that.
Someone down on Storm's End is going to get some tasty wings.
That's what I was thinking. There's delicious so many pieces wings that are falling to the ground. Like, somebody's going to see that and it's going to be a problem.
Those dragon bones are worth a lot. Like, wing bones, you just throw that away. But dragon bone, you're like, put in your pocket, you know, you're like, eat all the meat, stick it in your pocket.
The Dothraki use the dragon bones for their hunting bows, and they are exceptional range with them.
It's true. I wouldn't argue with
that. In the world of Westeros, do you think that those are the best bows, or do you think that something like Golden Heart might be better?
I think Golden Heart is slightly better, or is it?
I think it's Dragon Bone, as they said, is what I think they said. Dragon Bone is better.
It's just,
I think
better,
only Golden Heart's the only thing that's like
close to it.
Close to it. But only, and bones are, and it's the one that's most disseminated because the dragon bone bows are like super rare.
Yeah,
maybe not super rare, but rare. Like we've seen two, maybe. Maybe one. We saw the one that she gave to her blood rider.
Yeah,
and he still has it. Presumably, he's still around. But that's the only one I know of. There's probably more. I mean, we hear Illyrio is like a dragon bone dealer.
Yeah,
just doesn't come up much or at all, except for saying that he is. In fact, I don't even know he said it. It might have been Tyrion that said that.
Tyrion, when he is going to the wall, he reads a book called The Properties of Dragonbone.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
So the level up from that would be a dragonbone bow from the proper Valyria era that's been imbued from the sorcery, maybe an enchanted version.
Ooh, yeah.
Usually most medieval, I guess, hierarchies of the power and the distance, just the general attack points of, like I said, this is all we're going to be able to talk about for the next couple of years, guys. We're going to have to literally break everything down like this. Usually it goes the best wood that there is. So let's call it Golden Heart or some kind of weird magical yew or something. And then you'll go Dragon Bone. Dragon Bone's usually above the best wood. Maybe there's some kind of enchanted wood between the two that's like a short bow that shoots faster and causes more damage really quickly, but has less distance.
I think, we were always wondering about that. Like when Beleriand died, they get that big ass skull there, right? Like, what to do with the rest of him?
Mm-hmm.
Where's those bones?
Like, could that be used in a litter, like a royal litter? Could you use his skull to be some kind of a capsule for the king to travel during riots?
Cool. Yeah, that would be wild.
Shape of ankle bone into a cup or something and drink out of it, you know?
I would think hollow out like the toenail socket is what I think would be the best fit for that.
Toenail.
Just from going to museums.
Nice goblet.
You don't drink a fireball out of that.
I would, yeah.
We're all together in town because we saw George R. R. Martin last night here in New York City at the Symphony Theater. We had a really great time. There was us, a bunch of other A Song of Ice and Fire folks were in the room, and George R. R. Martin was interviewed by Neil Gaiman.
Mm-hmm.
It was a ton of fun. So we wanted to talk how that was, what the vibes were, and then we're also going to talk a little bit about Hot D just in general, get your guys' takes and thoughts now that, like you said, this is it for the next year and a half. But last night was a ton of fun. It was the first time that we'd all been in the same room since Ice and Fire Con, I think, or a lot of folks were there. So it was great to see people. Always a treat to hear from George. Did we get some new info from him last night? Hard to say, but we had a good time.
What do you guys think? Did we get any new info? Like actually new info?
Nothing really juicy. It was more anecdotal and it was more just George and Neil, the chemistry between them. They had great vibes and it was a bit more laid back and it wasn't super. Like Neil chose questions from the audience that were quite generic and, you know, not sort of risky. So I think as a writer, he understands not to ask the, you know, when's the book going to be out and so on, the more pointed questions. So it was a bit more of a relaxed conversation than, you know, getting scoops from the nerddom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they talked about a few things that you wouldn't necessarily normally hear him talk about because, like you said, because he was with Neil, and they talked about like things that only successful authors could commiserate about. You know, like, boy, it sure is hard signing so many books. Like, they talk about that, you know, like your wrist just gets, it makes sense. Like, yeah, you do thousands.
Do you think that his hand really did swell up, Neil Gaiman's hand?
I believe it. Yeah. I mean, just doing this repetitive thing, like maybe George has better, like, technique, you know? Like, I know that from, my mother's a musician. She talked about how important that is. Like, if you do it properly, you can do it. You can just keep doing it. But if you don't do it, if you have bad technique, your wrist will get sore, and then that'll cause you permanent problems long in the long run as a musician. So, like, these guys probably sign books as much as a lot of musicians play.
So that makes sense to me.
So we paid them to talk about that for a little bit. I thought that George offered probably the best perspective I've heard him talk about, and because of that, probably one of the most educated and personally educated perspectives on adaptations from literature to TV. That's a question or a conversation that I wanted to have more in depth when we had him on our podcast, and we didn't have enough time, or the conversation didn't open itself up to enough for him to really say what he said last night. And I really thought that was poignant, especially now being at the end of season one and everyone kind of celebrating Hot D as something that was adapted really well, or at least creatively in a way that made it feel like it was worth adapting. And then I guess that's choices of leaving stuff out or changing some things aside just as an adaptation. Do you guys think that Ryan and Miguel succeeded on the level that George maybe was talking about last night? And maybe this is to all three of you. And how do you think George feels about it in general based off of what your vibe is?
I think that George must be very pleased with House of the Dragon. I think that it was clear that Ryan Condal tried to carry off the whole thing in George's spirit. And I think there's evidence that, Ryan really understood the spirit of the books. For example, he included a lot of prophecy work, which was absent from Game of Thrones, and it's a whole register to the storytelling that, was really missing, but it's something that Ryan Condal valued very highly, and he kept playing with it. And the way he played with it, such as prophecies leading to errors in interpretation and people, drawing the wrong conclusions about them, is exactly in George's style. So I would say that he was paying close attention to the text and the subtext of the books.
Do you notice how just now in the inside of the episode we were watching, he was still saying he wasn't sure whether or not Aemond was sure about how he wanted to deal with Jace and the dragon? And he's giving you the inside scoop on it, and he's still that interpretation of the different perspectives from Fire and Blood, still keeping up that act in a behind-the-scenes documentary.
Yeah, that's cool. Like, and last night, George got asked that question directly, like, which is there a real version behind all this that you've obscured? Or did you just start with the obscurement and leave it there? And he said, yeah, the latter. He started with the obscurement and left it there. There is no true version. He didn't opt for that and thinks maybe that wouldn't be the right way to frame it, to have that, because it's supposed to be left ambiguous and it's supposed to be written like real history, and we're supposed to quibble even when we see what happens. Even when we know what happens, we quibble over it. We interpret it differently. So, I mean, not necessarily us, but people do. And that, so if people are going to quibble about something that they all saw, well, then, of course, they're going to quibble about something that none of them saw in history, right? You know, like things that make sense to them that don't make sense to other people. Yeah, we all, the idea of filtering it through our own experience and our own brains and our own unique perspectives is, you're right, that was really well captured, and that was really important to capture.
And I really like how much he talks about his experience with history and write, and, you know, this idea of trying to write history that's not really history. And he talked a lot about last night how he doesn't want to write historical fiction because he doesn't always like the way that history plays out. And so that conversation, in while also thinking about this broader kind of the way Fire and Blood was written and the way that the show was designed and carried out, hearing him talk about history that way, which I know we've heard that before, but I just find that very interesting to kind of be in his headspace. And so I think that in context with how they managed to translate onto the screen, kind of like we're saying, Ryan keeping the spirit of all of that was really well done.
It's definitely interesting when he talks about history, but he's a storyteller. So he views it, he loves history, but he views it through this lens of, you know, oh, it would make a better story if that guy didn't die, mm-hmm, which is mm-hmm. what he was talking about last night.
Yeah. It fits really well to have not only those uncertainties, but to, as George put it, to kind of embrace the embellishments, because that does make it more. So we can acknowledge that, as he did last night, that some of the details of the Scottish Black Dinner were added to make it sound cooler. But he's like, but that was a good choice. Mm-hmm. Like, that's good to make it sound cooler, especially if it's just adding and not changing the original. Like, if you're just like adding some fanfare and adding some music and a skull here or there. The fact is the basic event still happened. There still was an execution of these lords or whatever. So, but even when stuff is completely made up, that can still make for a good story, especially in a fictional environment. You're not worried about whether it's real or not. You know, does it matter if we're taking people away from the real historical record? In real history, you don't want to do that. You want to try to be accurate, but this isn't real history, so we get to have more fun with it.
So George is just trying to improve history.
Right, exactly. My question for you guys is, after watching House of the Dragon and reading Fire and Blood, while we were reading Fire and Blood, we were made to surmise a lot of things and come up with our own opinions, like we've been saying, about what happened, because we didn't get that straight through narrative. So did watching House of the Dragon change any of your opinions on maybe a character or a situation? Did it bring to light something that maybe you thought of differently while reading Fire and Blood?
I think my perspective is that you have to separate them. Okay, you've got the books, and it's complicated with three different stories, but I do view the show as made by a different person who wasn't always getting, you know, notes from George. So I see that as Ryan Condal's product.
Rondell.
That's for sure.
Yeah,
baby.
Rondell, yeah, I like that.
Yeah, Maine was born. but yeah, it was certainly interesting to get the characters fleshed out. And I think that one takeaway from the show is that, you know, there was more to the Greens than the history book show. And whether Ryan got that correct is open for debate, but there certainly was more to the story in the reality of this world than is said in the historical tome, and a lot of that is the characterization.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It's the characters, the way they filled in the blanks, because that's what there was a lot of room to do. I mean, they didn't change that much in terms of events. You know, they maybe moved some things around, changed the timelines and some things, but it was a pretty low impact as far as plot changes. But as far as fleshing things out that weren't fleshed out, or that the kind of things that you wouldn't expect to be in a historical record, like it wouldn't, because his history book probably wouldn't mention that Viserys was into models. But it might mention if he had
that scale, maybe though. At that scale,
at that scale, maybe it would. Yeah, at that scale, maybe.
What sort of models was he into?
But if you have someone like Daemon having a bad temper, that does impact his political decision. So that does get into his historical record. You know what I mean? Like, those are the kind of things. Like, if it affects history and decision making, then it tends to get in there. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. So they did such a great job with adding the details that you could see fitting, mm-hmm. right, without overwriting what was already there. And they did have a lot of room to play with it. So, but there's a lot of directions they could have gone.
Ton of room.
They could have easily done it poorly. You could easily see how certain characters could have been done improperly, or gave off the wrong vibes, or reacted in ways that we would find perplexing to certain events. But yeah, and they didn't dumb it down. I think that was a worry from Game of Thrones as well, that, you know, they started doing things because they thought people wouldn't understand it if they didn't, right? And that, I don't think it worked that well. I mean,
there's
maybe
a lot of shots of the dagger, though. You have to give me that.
Yeah, the dragon's eye.
And the dragon's eye in the promo art, it's like a sideways 2D version of the dagger.
Yeah, that's
with
so
like
cool.
No
that's
texture.
That's really the only, I feel like, heavy-handedness.
It looks really good, though.
Yeah.
I just want to say the dragon eye looks good, and I agree with you, too, Hannah, but it's still, I feel like we have to say it. We have to at least acknowledge it for what it is.
Yeah, I definitely thought it was a show that sort of expects its audience to be on the ball and smart, and like you say, they weren't sort of dumbing things down, and I think for the hardcore fans, that's quite gratifying. I'm not sure about casual fans because I think they're very important too, so I'm not trying to like dump on them. But yeah, I wonder how it went down with people that aren't invested and if they understood it and that they were able to follow. There's a lot of time jumps and it was very complex. So it would be interesting to have a conversation with a unsullied.
I'll give you my mom's phone number.
Yeah.
Only for only you, old boy.
Something that I heard this week a lot from friends was that they felt like House of the Dragon was really slow, especially at the beginning. Like they felt like it took a little bit more time for them to buy into the whole thing because you've got a new cast of characters and the TV show really plays itself out more like a book than it does in, you know, say season 7 or 8 of Game of Thrones. And so that was a piece of feedback I was hearing this week.
Hmm. Yeah. I talked to some Unsullied folks too. We have a roommate at my house and his girlfriend, and we've watched a few episodes with them, and the girlfriend hasn't seen the original show at all, so she's completely coming into new. And so she would have reactions. Whoa. Like episode 2, where it's like the sea snake is talking to someone, and we're like, oh, he's talking to Damon. And then it pans over to him, and he reveals it's Damon. She's like, whoa, Damon, whoa, this is cool. Yeah, like, all right, this is a good
like
team.
Like he traveled
up, you know?
All the way there.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So that was
so funny.
So that was neat. So like that... you're right. Like there's the time jumps are definitely going to be confusing to people and maybe a little off-putting, but the numbers are so strong. That's not all core viewers. They're not getting 10 million views an episode off of just core viewers. Cause there can't be that many core viewers. So I think what they discovered is that, remember, think back to the first show when people were confused about some of the characters then too. They're like, there's like 10 guys with beards or 10, that's way undersold. That's way underselling. It's like 10,000 guys with beards. And there were like the memes going around, like they kind of started to fade by like season 3, 4, 5, but like first season there'd be like, you know, wolf guy, you know, squid guy, like they had nicknames for casual viewers.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
like I think I wonder if they were doing
friend
that
zone,
for this
sir
one.
Friend zone.
This yeah sir, for sir friend zone. Yeah, Khaleesi was like, remember when no one knew her name, it was just Khaleesi.
Well, what, her name's not Khaleesi, what are you saying? We're so, show only podcast
thinking about that. There's a little bit that like trying to compare that to this, like where you get well, there's Joffrey and Joffrey, there's Viserys and Viserys, there's Aegon and Aegon.
And Aegon and Aegon.
Yeah. Eric and Arik.
Oh, God, what a slap in the face.
Vaemond, Aemond, and Daemon.
And Grover.
And Grover.
Of course, Elmo.
And then you have like the most standard name, like the most like real world name of all, Otto, right?
Rocket power, yeah.
So I think it's fun because what I think the point of all that, besides just having fun with all these names, is I don't think it didn't seem to be a big problem for casual viewers, right? The names. I don't know if that applies to other points of confusion, like being confused about plot elements is maybe worse than not knowing a character's name. But it seems like mild to even modest confusion isn't a big deal to a lot of viewers, long as the rest is like engaging and like the performances are strong, right?
I think even more so than GOT, people come into the scale of Westeros expecting to be a little silly, a little stupid, and kind of a let go of remembering people's names, because they also know, especially if they're starting GOT, even if they started it around year 3, which a lot of folks did, they know they have like 30 hours ahead of them to get good at it. So it's just kind of a fun way to interact with it, where you're just sort of
along for the ride.
You're along for the ride and you take the pressure off yourself. You're like that guy who died. I think going into a new one, it was always a gamble. Were they going to lean into that and make it a spectacle, or was it going to be a dank drama that also has, well, I guess not just comedy, I was going to say with touches of comedy, but like A Song of Ice and Fire and like GOT and like really anything good, the top tier television shows or movies, they have this vein of something that's a very significant genre defining characteristic of itself, but it also shows like everything about being a human, the funny stuff, the sad stuff, the real stuff, the magnificent stuff, the sneaky, the friendly, the heartfelt, the hopeful, the depressed. And that's what's, you know, happening right now in Hot D. But I think going into it, we could know that people are going to be expecting a certain way to interact with Westeros, GOT being really the defining television show of the teens, and about how we all sum up online culture. It sums up online culture. It did sum up online culture. It defined online culture. So there was this chance the whole time, was this just going to be a facsimile of that same thing before, and like a sort of a victory lap, a masturbatory celebration of what the potential of this new thing could be? Or is it going to happen again naturally? And it seems to me, I don't know if it's wishful thinking, we basically in this conversation been sitting here and been saying that it happened naturally. Do you guys really believe that it did? That the love and the respect for it is from a place of its own origin, or is it left over from before, or is it just relief that it doesn't suck?
I think obviously it was a show that was benefiting from the popularity of its predecessor, but it could have crashed and burned so easily. And like Aziz was saying, you wouldn't be getting the numbers. You'd be getting a lot of people that were giving up mid-season. I don't think that was the case. It was maintaining.
It grew. Remember after the first episode?
Yeah. Aren't a lot of people watching Rings of Power though, right?
Sure.
And you can't say the exact same thing for the Rings of Power.
Yes. Lots of people were watching it. But just today I was reading how Amazon has not released viewership numbers on it, like full viewership numbers on it. Like it said it was close to one of their milestones earlier in the season. And then it's kind of gone quiet on numbers since then. And in that same article, I read that Rings of Power is apparently doing poorly with younger audiences, unlike House of Dragons doing really well. I think the quote was, it was on TikTok, the hashtag House of Dragon had 7 billion views, and the hashtag Rings of Power was like 8 million.
Jeez.
Oh, it can't be 8 million. That's crazy. No, because they claimed they got 28, 29 million on episode one, right?
No, this is TikTok. This is TikTok views. TikTok hashtag views.
So with the teens.
So there's like 200,000 views if it's TikTok.
There's no like hottie dances.
Maybe it was 80 million. Maybe it was 80 million, but it was shockingly smaller than House of the Dragon. Like whoa, like orders of magnitude smaller.
So why do you guys think that is? Why do you think that?
Because Rings of Power was boring.
why do you think that the way that this book is being adapted, and the last one too. I mean, we talked about this 100 million times, but it's for the sake of now, in the framework of being right after George last night and right after season one of Hot D, why do you think that it's still working versus other stuff that's expensive and looks good and has great lore?
I think George R. R. Martin is just at the peak of his powers, and the source material is so strong, and it's finished. It was just ripe for conversion into the visual media, but you know, they still had a lot of work to do because it wasn't something that was going to be easily transposed, but you know, that was the work and they'd done it successfully. So it, from the ground up, it's quality. There's nothing that you can criticize. Well, this person didn't know what they were doing, just from the source material to, you know, the final effects, everything was in sync. And yeah, maybe they benefited from all those years of doing Game of Thrones to sort of perfect and streamline the product, and feel like everyone involved in this show knows exactly what they're doing, and that's why you're getting such a high quality TV show.
I also think that you, with something like House of the Dragon, you get the high fantasy without being too like highbrow. You know, I think that for something like Lord of the Rings or Rings of Power, the barrier of entry seems a lot steeper, especially because of the source material. You look at House of the Dragon, you can come in, and I think they catered some of the show to, you've never seen Game of Thrones before, or you're being introduced to the Targaryens for the first time, or this is a new thing for you. And so I feel like one of the strengths of House of the Dragon and Game of Thrones in general is the ability to have these intensely mystical themes. Like, we're talking dragon dreams, and we're talking all the like prophecy, like you've been saying. You know, dragons and magical swords and, you know, all of the things that we love about fantasy without it being too snooty, I guess. And I'm not saying that Lord of the Rings is snooty in the slightest, but you know what I mean? Like, it's a little bit more accessible, I feel like, to newer audiences.
Really, it's a political drama. You know, it's a drama with fantasy elements. It's not like, at the heart of it is a story about families. So Yeah, just to compare, I don't want to compare too much about Rings of Power, but that did seem to lack focus. But you can say off the bat, this House of the Dragon is, you know, a familial drama, and it's something we all recognize. Throw those fantasy elements in, and I think you pull people in that may not otherwise have necessarily been inclined to consume fantasy. But like you say, the mix of the drama with a sprinkling of the fantasy and a few dragons has pulled people in from outside the, you know, the catchment area of the show. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. The relatability of the characters, even if you're not, we're not royals, you know, they have the struggles of regular people, like fighting over ownership of things that belong to a family, like, you know, family squabbling over who gets the granddad's chair. You know, this is a much more powerful chair in this case. But, you know, that kind of thing could happen on a smaller scale. But yeah, like, it's hard to relate, or like, Morfydd Clark, great actress, but it's hard to relate to Galadriel, an immortal being of lived thousands of years that, you know, exists in this realm of light, right? It's a little harder to glom onto that as a character. And that also, that just permeated a lot of the Rings of Power, a lot of characters that are cool and interesting, but they're not that relatable. Their situations aren't very relatable. But when they add a few of the characters that were invented for that show did seem to be kind of relatable. And I think they showed that those were some of the characters that got the best acclaim in that show. So if it should kind of proves the point that that's what people want. They need more relatability. They need more something to pick out of all this fantasy that applies to them as well. Something that you could understand. See, I can understand why this makes him sad, or I can understand why this is frustrating. It's not entirely clear. Like for Galadriel, you're like, okay, she wants to revenge her brother. That makes sense, right? That's they can relate to that. But the methods and the like trekking through snow and fighting snow trolls is, to chase an immortal enemy, it's really cool, but it's different. It is hard to compare. Like I'm with Yoke Boy that I don't want to over compare them, but they're happened at the same time, so it's hard not to. And they're so huge, and yeah, you can't throw money at everything. Like some of these things, it seems like they just had a better plan, and you said better source material. Is that's true? Because they're not drawing
the source material
directly.
Great for Rings of Power. That scene you're mentioning is in a place called Eregion that I used to look at on the edge of the map when I was a little kid. And the way they came out the gate swinging with this TV show was to literally show me one of the characters I've been seeing since I was a kid, but thousands of years in the past, as they were earning their stripes, climbing a fucking mountain that region. I was like, holy crap, this is going to be my favorite show of all time.
You're the extreme target audience for Rings of Power.
Oh, for sure. For sure. But still, like, what
you're
saying.
That's a logistical issue, right? Like, this is supposed to happen over a long period of time, which it's hard to, like, a 10-year time jump that was hard to do. House of the Dragon pulled it off, but it was hard to do. But like, had they done time jumps in Rings of Power, they would have had to have been a lot bigger.
Man, I think the time jumps in Hot D did a favor for it, because I felt like they did what basically the first four seasons or maybe three seasons of GOT did for folks, of showing those different eras of the character that you like so much and how much their relationship changed with their sort of antithesis to their character. Someone like Rhaenyra versus Allison, or Daemon versus Allison, or even Daemon versus Viserys, you know, or Viserys versus life itself. Instead of waiting for a long time, it's like they gave us a treat of, you've been waiting for Game of Thrones to come back, so you're getting like three seasons right now. And the time jumps were, I just thought, so well executed that I liked it because of it. I didn't want more time in any of the other periods in Hot D. I was like, I got enough of all these. I'm getting tired of it. There was definitely more periods that I would have liked to have seen, but I thought that the time jump served to just skip us ahead a little bit further than the last time the show came around. It's like if your favorite author followed up. It's like if George wrote a new fantasy series, right? And it didn't take him till the end of the book for the dragons to come back, or for Feast or Dance to come around for you to go, this is going to get Euron weird real quick. It's just like if you knew super quick, because he just knew how to get there faster. Yeah. I felt like they used the time jumps to get us all there as an audience faster. And then this is ideal for them. I don't know if it's successful for everyone, but I know for all you guys are crazy. You guys love this show. So they convinced you guys to like it. So I hope that everyone, I'm wondering if everyone else was tricked in the same way to start talking about these characters like we've been watching them for years, like the other show. People are doing that, you know?
Yeah.
They really are, and I think
they're familiar already.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like you're saying with the time jumps, that could have been really jarring. That could have broken the season, you know. It could have been, people could have been really confused, but I think people love this universe so much they're willing to put up with a bit of complication. And I also think that they handle the time jumps very smoothly, considering they're bringing new actors and so on and so on. And that they have carved out this generational story, and well, we're over the time jumps now. Mm-hmm. And the jarring thing was when we went back to the days slowing down, like the last three episodes were like over 3 days, and it was like, oh my God, you know, it used to be like 10 years each time.
Did you guys think that maybe those felt like the best versions of a GRM chapter adapted to HBO without the constant interruption of going to different locations and it not being focused around a battle? It just really felt like, you know, you start in Marine with Danny and it's like Hizdar is going to visit today and you're like, okay, well, that's going to be something. And then someone pulls you off to the side and they go, well, I have a lot of stuff to talk to you about. And then you start thinking about everyone that's interacting with that problem. Like the Green Graces are talking to Barristan. That's crazy. And then eventually you deal with Hizdar, and then there's the falling action of your meeting with Hizdar. That's basically what each of those Queen episodes were. Mm-hmm. They were the sense of space of dealing with the governance of the problem at the time. And I just felt like, well, give me more of this. Give everyone. This is like a Mad Men episode. It was like, I woke up this morning and I have to do a pitch later today. And my wife's giving me trouble. And one of my kids faked sick and he's staying home from school. And I got to deal with all of it. And we got that at the end of something that was jumping 10 years in between episodes.
Yeah, I agree. It did make a lot of sense to frame it primarily between the two queens and the prince and the king as well would be, you know, just almost as primary, I suppose you could say. But yeah, they're the driving force. And as because they cast it so well and wrote such compelling character conflict for those two, everything just sprang out so well from that. And as readers, we were not surprised by the quality of Rhaenyra's arc, right? I think that we were pleasantly surprised by how good the acting was.
That's what I was impressed by.
But we knew that that was a compelling character already. Alicent, like a lot of the Greens, as we've kind of talked about off and on in this episode, there's a lot of spots where the Greens were like,
This is way more interesting
than we thought. And we knew that going in, that this was a core problem. The fandom massively prefers the blacks to the greens. It's still probably true, but it's probably a little less true, and there's definitely more room to discuss the nuance of certain decisions. Like, even if you still come out thinking that the greens are in the wrong, you can point to several things the greens did that were not wrong. Like, you could say, okay, well, this thing they were doing. And then, of course, with more time going by, that probably it might even balance out a little more. Maybe not, but regardless, they did such a good job of taking the characters that we previously disliked or thought were kind of flat and making them really strong, really three-dimensional. And repeatedly they did this. I was like, it's amazing enough that they did that with Alicent. But they also did it with Aemond. They made Helaena more interesting. She's not really in the book that much, right? She's not Fire and Blood. She doesn't have a big role.
And also, we feel a little sorry for Aegon, too. Imagine that at this point in Fire and Blood.
I felt sorry for Otto once or twice, which I was like, afterwards, I was like, I felt a little dirty. Why do I feel bad for Otto?
That's love you're feeling. That's desire, disease. Deep down desire.
I had to auto-correct.
But we did get that nuance that we were hoping, the nuance that we were hoping that we would get. And we were talking, while we were rewatching the episode or the finale, we were talking about the whole Aemond scene when he does this thing, this terrible thing. And when you read it in the book, that's an evil act of war. Yeah. But when you see it on the TV show, he freaks out because he made a mistake, and the dragons did that. Like the dragons kind of got away from them a little bit, and
dragons
so
did do that, or that dragon did that.
That dragon did that. So it just, I have lots of thoughts, but the first one was, I remember like at the very beginning of the series, it was like Team Green or Team Blacks, and we're all like, why would you need to pick a side? Like, it's so clearly obvious who is, we're all Team Blacks, right?
You got with their dad, you lose, man.
Right, and so, but yeah, I agree with all of this, just that color and nuance, and just like the looks between everybody. This whole season added a 1,000 lines of dialogue, essentially, between all of these different characters, and so it was well acted. And it was just like added so much life to everybody on screen.
Real quick, I just want to remember something really funny. Okay, so I saw a poll, I think it was on Reddit, that was like, well, they tried to make the greens and blacks more evenly balanced by, you know, by viewers. It looks like they failed because the poll said like 83% black, 17% green. And I was thinking to myself, when I posted that poll on Twitter, it was like 91-9. So that is an improvement.
When we asked on our show,
everyone's hot. That helps.
Yeah, it does help. But we asked on our show midway through the season if you were Team Green or Team Black.
No, it was before that. It was before we met George, because we told him about that.
But we did both. We did both. Oh, remember, okay. We did that before we met George, like way long ago, and then we did one about halfway through the season as one of our midweek questions.
I can't remember that. What was the results for the second one?
Probably like 60-40.
Oh, it was 80-20 the first time. So it was almost originally what you just got, Aziz.
Exactly. Just to kind of add evidence to that.
I think Kristen Cole really hurts the numbers of the Greens a lot, right? He's just so pissed off about everything. So we're like, we're not going to support him. But you can also, if you are a Green supporter, or even if you like Allison's dill, or if you're an auto-apologist, an autologist, then you would probably like just write Kristen Cole off and be like, yeah, you need a bulldog that's, it doesn't matter how he is. He just needs to be a killer. I was just looking at our episode list for some reason a couple days ago, and I saw a Halloween one from 2 or 3 years ago where we were talking about Hot D, and that's been a lot of time for us to think about Fire and Blood getting adapted for television. When you guys had this picture in your head, I know that I had one in my head cooking in there about how the next successor show was going to look, or how Fire and Blood was going to look, how this era was going to look adapted for television. What did you see in your head? If you can give me insight on a little glimpse that you saw in your head before you knew, and then how did that compare, and were you disappointed or were you excited about what they came up with and ended up showing you?
Definitely was very aware that there were major holes in the characterization, and that, you know, just as someone who's very cautious about pop culture stuff, just a part of me was afraid that they would get it wrong. And I did not expect the show to get so many things so right. And I guess a bit of pessimism about, you know, what the show could be, but I think that it's for a lot of fans, we feel that it's exceeded our expectations, and that it wasn't just sort of a quick cash in on Game of Thrones, quick what can we throw together next to keep the numbers up. I didn't get that impression, and it's a great show in its own right that could be watched without Game of Thrones and stands on its own 2 feet. And as we've covered, they filled up these character holes so well, and I don't think that was easy.
Yeah, you know, if you think about it, it happened all so fast because Fire and Blood came out in late 2018, and here it is 2022, and we've already got a season in the books. Like, that's fast, right? Like, you think about it, like, it took a while to make the show. And yeah, so this kind of does imply some of the behind-the-scenes stuff that we heard about ahead of time, that George made it more of a priority because there was rumblings of this sort of thing happening, and it's exactly what did happen. They had already started thinking about what was going to be next before season 8 had aired. And you know, since that time, there's been a lot has changed, COVID, and a lot of executives have been swapped out at HBO. But yeah, Yoke Boy's right, it could have easily crashed, and I was maybe a little more optimistic than he was, but I was there's definitely a lot of caution in my optimism too, because it's like, yeah, well, just like everybody else, the last thing that we saw was season 8. So we're like, well, if they do it like that, and we had plenty of reason for optimism because it wasn't going to involve a lot of the same people, right? Even, you know, even people who did a good job in season 8 weren't going to be included for the most part. So that's just with a whole new team, you at least have that reason to believe, well, it's a whole new group of people. HBO's got a good track record. But yeah, really couldn't have expected this, and I'm so glad. I just can't get it. Can't say more about that. Just effusive praise.
I remember being at Ice and Fire Con this year, and David J. Peterson said that he'd seen the scripts as the High Valyrian translator, and that he thought they were very high quality, and he wasn't sort of shilling. It was obvious he was being sincere. And at that point, I was like, oh, we might have something really good on our hands here.
He said it was just great writing, you know, which was like, okay, well, hopefully we agree with your taste on that. Because he had also, I don't know if you remember this, yoke boy, right before he said that, he also said that he agreed with the show cutting Stoneheart. So I was like, maybe we shouldn't agree. Maybe we should. Maybe I don't agree with David on what's good and what isn't. But for the most part, no, you're still right, though. It was clear he's being sincere, because he's worked on a lot of scripts, and he's a critical guy. He's not going to hold back. He's an honest guy. He's not going to say something that isn't that waters down his opinion just to make people happy. So yeah. When you get straight dope from him, I think.
Unless he got offered a lot of money, then.
Well, you know, everybody's got their limitations, right?
You guys were, is tepid the right word?
Like in expecting expectations?
Nervous about it?
I think I was more than tepid. I think I was excited, but
there
was an element of fear, like this could suck. But I was overall excited because I figured it would probably be good, and I didn't figure even if it wasn't great, it probably wouldn't be terrible. Right. Like, and even season 8 was heavily watched. So like from the business side, like, well, this is going to be, you know, we're all going to have something new to talk about. And hopefully it's not terrible, because then it'll be really painful to talk about and pretend we like it. But if it's at least pretty good, that's all it needs. We only needed it to be pretty good. So that was part of my expectations. Like, oh, you know, like, am I worried it was going to be bad? Yes. But I don't need it to be great. I hope it's great, but I just hope it's pretty good. And it's definitely way better than that.
It makes me think about like a BTS when we were podcasting and kind of going through the slog of season 8. We'd like get to the midweek rewatch and I'd be like, I literally cannot rewatch this episode right now. Like, I could just do the episode. We can do the podcast without needing to rewatch.
I'm going to fuck the queen.
Yeah. So, but with House of the Dragon, I was always psyched to rewatch the episodes in the middle of the week. Like, the rewatchability was through the roof. And so from our selfish perspective, the fact that there was a lot of things to talk about and we weren't just having to quote cool lines, no disrespect, because, you know, that's what Owens are, but a success. Well, so my question is then, so success season 1, loved it. We are unsure how long we're going to have to wait to get to season 2. We haven't had anything officially announced yet. What are your hopes and dreams for season 2? I mean, we've talked about, and George talked about how he could take four seasons to talk about the dance, for that to get the attention that it deserves. We're talking about time jumps not being part of the equation anymore. What are your guys' hopes and dreams and thoughts about season 2, just from a vibes perspective?
I think that there's a lot of potential, because season 1 was only set in a few places, right? So season 2 can expand and show us more of the world, which everyone finds exciting. We're going to go to places that we've been in Game of Thrones, which is going to be a huge nostalgia hit. And there's also going to be new, you know, other places where we haven't seen yet. So settings wise, we've got everything to look forward to. And as Damon mentioned, there are a bunch more dragons that we haven't seen. And the whole dragon side of the story is just going to get more and more exciting, and people are going to get more and more into it. And that's going to be a big winner and a big pull for people, I think.
Absolutely agree with that. There are a number of big action scenes coming in season 2, which we always appreciate, but hope they don't, you know, over-focus on. We want the story to drive the action, not the other way around. And there's, I'm not worried about that, given how they've done things so far. But it is a curiosity I have how they're going to handle it. And I mean, there's like, if you look at Fire and Blood, there's a lot of big budget items coming this season. So in terms of expenditures, like last night, George talked about legitimate versus illegitimate changes in a script.
Horses
the
Coliseum,
the Stonehenge.
Yeah. Stonehenge, yeah.
So like he was talking about, we're doing a script that involves Roger Zelazny, and he had to ask Roger Zelazny, like, which, we only have the budget for one of these things, which do we do? Do we have the forest or do we have Stonehenge? And Zelazny took a puff off his pipe and thought about it for a minute and said, Stonehenge.
The best part there is that George was like, I don't know what to do, but I'm friends with the guy's thing that we're adapting, so I'm going to ask him.
Which is what we get the impression Condal does.
Exactly.
We get the impression that Condal texts George and is like, hey, George, what would you do here? What's more important to keep? You
That's know, so
like,
harmonious, man. Yeah. That's so nice.
Dave and Dan were not texting George about these little things, I don't think. Like, from there, it doesn't sound like he was. Like, from either of their camps, don't
Why
report
can't
such
life
a thing.
Be that way?
Yeah.
If it is, maybe you get a show this good for four seasons, right? Maybe more.
So I'm really looking forward to, like, how they handle people's reactions to all this battle. Like, this is a big scene, a big part of season one was no one here's fought in war. Mm-hmm. Like, with a few exceptions, there's a few exceptions. Daemon fought in the Stepstones. Corlys Velaryon's got plenty of battle experience. But for the most part, these guys who are clamoring for war, I don't know what they're getting into. And that's going to create some really interesting character moments, some, like, trauma and realizing I've made a huge mistake. And people who just have no control. Like, we're going to see lower-level commanders, like Matt said. We're going to see Starks. We're going to see more Lannisters. We're going to see Stormlanders and Rivermen and all these other stuff. We might see Iron Islands, we might see all sorts of stuff. The sprawl of the original Game of Thrones will be present in a way that it hasn't quite been here. So that's real. There's a lot of characters within that. That's what I'm looking forward to, is like, how is, we joke about the Muppet Tullys, but those could be really interesting characters, like, despite their silly names, you know? We could get, like, the women in the Vale, Lady Jane and Jessamine and these other characters that are there, that could be really interesting. What are they going to do with them? Young Reyna, are they going to change her story, or is she just going to go to the Vale and live the life Alicent said sounded awesome? You know, like, where she just has people jousting for her, trying to win her hand, and she's waiting for dragon to hatch, and like, she's having a pretty good time there. But that's a lot of characters. It's like, I think there's more characters introduced in season two than we have had in season one. I think it's a larger amount are being added than already exist, which is kind of hard to think about. And it's like, wow, that's a lot of sprawl. So there's a lot of new characters that are in a similar state in Fire and Blood than a lot of the characters like we cited, Allison, Aemond, Otto, whoever, that we didn't know a lot about. So many more characters that they can explore, and given how well they did these ones, I'm really excited to see how they handle different types of characters, like non-courtly, non-Targaryen.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Is it possible that we connect more to the point of view of people that have never fought in battle before but may have access to the power of dragons than the truth of all of our relationships? If you were to put yourself in the role of a character, maybe your favorite character from watching Game of Thrones, I like Ghost a lot. But in the first episode, I don't really relate to Ghost as a puppy. Do you know what I'm saying? Or even Ned or any of his kids, really, you know?
That's a good point.
But I think we can all sort of feel Aemond. We've all been kind of mad and like, oh shit.
We've all actually killed
one of our.
Yeah.
And so is it possible? I know that it's almost insane. I bet that GRM would think it was insane too, to even guess that the depth of the cast on Fire and Blood could get as in tune with the universe as the Game of Thrones cast was. Characters like Arya and Cersei existing at the same time, the different direwolves and how everyone played off against each other. And then you have Sala come off from the side and you're like, wait a second, Sala or San's a real guy? And those layers keep going from there. I can't say that, even having read Fire and Blood a couple times, that it had that same resonance with, I guess, what everyone's looking for in TV shows and movies and books as the first cast of characters did in the first series in mm-hmm. Azeroth. But that situation that we just talked about, that sort of innocence while dealing with the power of Westeros, even though it's before our current, or it's before Game of Thrones, our current Azeroth storyline in time, it seems like it's a further ahead in conception of how us as an audience will interact with it. And he did write it later. And so he was a better writer when he came up with the Fire and Blood storyline. Like I said, the characters might not be Arya, but I think that we're probably at the beginning of how much people are liking Hot D, especially off the tail end of what you just were talking about, Aziz, the explosion of Westerosi content with through characters and locations that we're going to get in the next one. People are going to like that so much more. And the situation's going to fire off with the audience that watches it even more than the audience that watched Game of Thrones did. The only thing that we're lacking is Arya maybe reading off her list and traveling with Jorn. That kind of thing is really hard to replace. We're not going to get that in Hot D. We're not going to get that sense of real organic differences in ages of our characters and traveling and differences of situations, but in how we relate to these characters fucking up an otherwise perfect world. Everyone that watches that is going to relate, from the president down to someone watching it in a bar that doesn't have TV at their own house. They're going to be like, oh, I do that.
It's definitely character-wise, I guess you have to accept that it's a different story and that the actual tone of the writing is different in both stories. So yeah, it's difficult to compare characters like Arya and Jon Snow and Daenerys, you know, cultural icons and some of the best characters ever conceived. So House of the Dragon is just different, and you know, it's mainly within one family and they have all the power, so it's a different study. It's more like Succession with dragons, I like to think about it.
But like someone like Nettles, they have the potential to be a huge fan favorite character on a level that maybe no one else ever has, just because of the scenarios in which these characters are engaging with.
I totally agree. And she quite potentially will be more relatable than even like an Arya.
What I'm saying.
Like Arya is... to be fair, Arya is extremely hard to stack up to. Arya is probably the most popular character from the books.
It's like all of our
childhood.
She's
probably number one.
Bottled up in her.
There are potential characters that, you're right, that people can embrace that we won't necessarily know. We won't see it coming necessarily.
Right, that's what I'm trying to say.
Because we don't know how they're going, like,
or how good season
two
is
going
to be. So right, it could be just as rich as the original series, and boom, we got a new phase.
We knew Arya was going to be big in the show. We're like, oh, look at that casting. That's perfect. Look at her. Maisie Williams, that is an ass. Look at that. She looks exactly like what everybody figured. Like, she was one of the best castings amidst a bunch of amazing castings. So we could kind of predict that she was going to be popular. But it's a lot harder to do that with Fire and Blood because of the source. Nature is the source material. You don't glom with characters the same way in a history book you do with, like, when you're in their head, you know, and you see their feelings and their conflicts and all that. You really attach yourselves more to them.
Well, if you take some of the action scenes, we've talked a lot about the characters, but look at the action scenes. What about Vhagar? The chase scene, that no one could have imagined it. So even in your imagination, you can't have imagined it being so perfect, the way that it was paced and that the effects and the drama that, you know, exceeded what was in my head about that scene when you're reading the sort of black and white tome of a history book, although it's exciting. If you look at some of the really action-y scenes in the Fire and Blood, they're over very quickly. They're in like one or two paragraphs and they're done, you know, before you know it. You've finished reading it, and although it's a huge scene, there's not really that much description going on.
With Daemon versus Crabfeeder, what do you guys think about that?
Well, it was pretty cool. I mean, I think there were some complaints about it, but I thought it was cool. Not big complaints, but there were some, like, the whole no arrows don't hit anybody kind of thing. People just couldn't find it too believable.
For sure.
But I don't know. I liked it a lot.
That whole thing felt like a trippy sequence.
Yeah.
I sort of wrote that off as an artistic expression versus real life survival.
Yeah, it was just really, it was really efficient, and I thought they needed something kind of outlandish to establish his reputation.
Sure.
Like that, he had that reputation in Fire and Blood for being a great warrior. He had acquired it, and they have to show that, like, he put awe and, like, everyone who saw that, like, I mean, I'm not talking about the audience, I'm talking about his men who saw that were like, whoa. Like, he may not be a great leader,
nice face.
But if he's charging, you know, you can follow him and expect it'll go well. You know, like, maybe his planning isn't great, but if he's leading the charge, you're doing pretty well. So I think that was brilliant. That kind of makes him more like the Targaryens being closer to gods than men. You do something like that, it's like, we in my show, we talked a lot about how it was shades of, like, Achilles just
carving a swath through everyone. No one could stop him. And especially given it was on a beach and all this other stuff, horsehair helmet, you know, fun stuff like that.
You think about Troy or like the myth?
Yeah, that both. Well, both. Right. But it, particularly, it's hard not to picture Brad Pitt's Troy because that's the one that's seared like into that? Our imagination.
Is that what you're saying?
And it was written by
Dave Benioff.
By Dave Benioff. Yeah. So, yeah, I was like, hey, you know, it's funny thing about that. Like, right, what, that's, isn't that what?
Ready? Two,
ha ha ha. Okay.
It's like you have to do the stock laugh and then record the reaction to the stock laugh.
Hey,
that's the real laugh.
Exactly.
The fake laugh generates the real laugh.
Yeah. A little behind the scenes here. We haven't had you guys on this whole season, and so I wanted to see if we can get your owns of the season. Your favorite part, favorite line, favorite scene, favorite character. We can make this really broad, but from both of you, kind of what your own of the season would be.
Okay.
Or the series.
Maybe I gave myself way early, but own to Vhagar for, you know, for satiating his hunger.
Right? Like, it just takes it back to the basics. We're all hungry.
Not even a big meal, just a snack.
Yeah, I mean, considering how large that dragon is, that wasn't really much of a meal. Like, he probably eats like 12 aurochs a day or something. Probably not that much, but a substantial amount of meat goes down that gullet per day. My own goes to casting director Kate Rhodes James. We talked about how great the cast was and how much they added so much to the story. So naming one person, I don't want to name one actor, one particularly, it's hard to name, just pick one out of so much greatness. So I think this is a good person to pick in that sense.
Your boy's still on the mic. Get that. You're ready.
In terms of like giving an own to someone in the cast or crew, I think Paddy Considine.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, like, as he said, there's a whole cast of amazing performances and there was very little in the way of imperfections, but talking about pure perfection, Paddy Considine's declining Viserys was fantastic. Every episode and every scene, he was perfect.
I miss that guy.
We're gonna miss him, right? Yeah. If I did have to pick one, I won't. I'll pick two. I'll pick four. The two the actors that played Rhaenyra and Allison. We in our show we did a poll every week to see which one was best, and I picked them. Like 7 or 8 out of the 10 times they won. Like Paddy Considine won after week 8. But yeah, they were just so good. So they get the owns. They owned my heart.
All right. Owns for the final episode of Hot D Season 1. From @StraightSavageCole on Twitter. My main own goes to the huge ass table of Westeros getting another cameo. And for all the amazing uses and shots they got out of it. Secondary own to when Daemon refers to Aegon as the drunken usurper cunt of a king. That was just absolutely glorious. # ghost kills Ollie 2K16.
Yes! Never forget.
Next up we have Hugo Castellano says own to Ewan Mitchell / Aemon Targaryen for actually making me believe that he didn't mean to do what he did at the very end of the episode and just wanted an eye for an eye.
From @McGarrity, man, I don't even know anymore. Owned Queen Rhaenyra, first of her name, through the lowest low, rising higher than ever, fighting to keep the realm from plummeting into bloodshed, and then that last look says it all. Incredible. My house knows no ruler but the rightful queen. Owned to Corlys for his halftime motivational speech moment. It was straight up Friday Night Lights, clear eyes, full hearts,
K7.
Final own of the season has to go to this episode and show as a whole. Everyone involved was on a whole other level from beginning to end. After a full season, I feel confident in proclaiming this to be better than peak GOT. Long live Hot D.
Okay, this one is from Boyd at Boyd's 1212. Own to Storm's End, where no matter what the weather's like when you arrive, it will be effing bananas outside when you leave. # Hot D finale. Yep.
From @BrentoBox. Own to Otto, because damn, those balls are huge. I was going to say that.
Amanda Taylor at SoCute Amanda, do we have owns or do we just have tears? My poor sweet Luke and Arax. My own has to go to the painted table lit with fire. I wonder if Melisandre knew it could do that.
Man, talk about information lost in time over ages, guys. If they would have known that whole time those little cubby holes weren't for storing parchment and scrolls. You'd roll a candle in there, guys.
from at Abnawra, owned that glimpse of Vermithor and his fiery entrance to Daemon Song. Can't wait to see the Bronze Fury in action next season. Hashtag Valyrian Spotify playlist. Hashtag Fire and Blood. Hashtag Sing Me a Song, My Prince. Hashtag 2K22. Hashtag Hot D.
Sir Booksage at Sir Booksage, owned to Arax for being a true dragon, trying to protect his Targaryen and taking his shot at Vhagar when it was there. That's a good one, although I'm not sure about the consequences of that.
Do you think Arax just thought he was like, this is just, we're having fun, right?
What if he'd roasted Aemon in that one pot shot?
My.
That would be an excellent little puff.
Yeah.
And then he gets several owns.
You could have ended the war right here. At Troy Tim, owned a Luke. He didn't back down.
Eloquent Adventures owns to Rhaenyra for throwing a funeral and a coronation at the same time.
At Black Madness 317, owned to my future self, justifying every atrocity Rhaenyra and Daemon commit for the rest of the show.
At Stephanie Brightback, owned to Emma for making me cry just from watching the back of their head when she found out about Luke.
At Aswolf Quotes, GOT, owned to Storm's End. I've been waiting to see it in all of its glory for years.
At Crash 2K18, owned to Rhaenys. I was salty AF that she didn't light them up last week, but she made a good point about not being her war to start. Also, her reactions all episode. Oh, you're counting on my dragon?
Fingernail polish emoji.
From Careless Coy at Coy at Sivanazi 1620. What's up, Coy? My own goes to Aemon for the sweet, sweet gemstone, that lovely sapphire.
Democracy Diva says, own to Rhaenys, still standing when everyone else on Dragonstone has knelt, unbowed, unbent, unbothered.
At Erica Kiana, own to Sir Eric for being the man Sir Criston wishes he could be.
Jason Alden, own is to Rhaenys for finally telling Corlys to get off his high seahorse already.
Nice. At Riles the Lion, owned to Viserys for being right about dragons. Nice one.
At J. Denari Duff, owned to Ramindradi's score. The music in the map room was fire. Oh, yes.
And our last one for this episode. At Crimson Grits, Rhaenyra got owned. Been at Dragonstone for years and didn't see it coming. Also, owned to Aemon for being the only person who ages. So Aziz, well, as we're closing out, can you tell us about the mystery surrounding Ewan Mitchell and how perfectly it continues to carry that Euron/Aemon lore forward?
It really does do that, doesn't it? He because of him appearing to be older than his older brother, Aegon, people have been wondering how old he is. This man has pulled off a very difficult thing. He's been in Hollywood for a while. He was on the show Last Kingdom. That wasn't the first show he was on. He's been on things before that. The Last Kingdom had 5 seasons, and it wasn't a once-a-year show, so it took many years to run. So this dude, so we don't know how old he is, and we tried to figure it out. Couldn't. Like, he's kept his age concealed online. It's a hidden fest. Well played. Owned to Ewan Mitchell for somehow hiding his age in this day and age from the public, despite being on several huge budget TV shows. He's just managed to keep that quiet somehow. Hopefully, maybe in 10 years, we still won't know. And maybe he'll look like he hasn't aged and be like, oh, he's the one who hasn't aged. We had it backwards. He was the only one who looked like he aged, and now he's, I don't know.
He's going to look really old.
What does a sapphire yeah. do to you? Like, does that make you age
a
slower?
A necklace, an eye. Thank you both for coming on our show. It's been so much fun to hang out with you and to spend time together and to talk Hot D. It's been a lot of fun. So why don't you let everybody know, both of you, where folks, for some reason, don't know how to find you. Let them know where they can find you.
Okay. So I'm from podcast Radio Westeros. You can find us wherever you find your podcasts. And we also have a YouTube channel, Radio Westeros, where we do live stream reviews of the House of the Dragon. Obviously, that's not going to happen for a while, but come and subscribe. Thank you.
I'm Aziz from History of Westeros, and you can find us in the same places that Yoke Boy just said you can find Radio Westeros, except you want to search History of Westeros. But after you've subscribed to Radio Westeros, you can come over to us. And we're also on YouTube. We're on anywhere you find podcasts. And yeah, we'll be doing plenty of stuff in the off season, talking about different characters, looking at their arcs and stuff from the books. Yeah, it's a bright future for this fandom. And thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.